This is Pat Loika, and you're listening to Loika Mania. You're listening to Loika Mania episode 39. My name is Pat Loika, and once again, I am joined by my good buddy Adam Witt. Adam?
What's up, everybody? What's up, Pat?
Not much. We are here today because we have another special guest. Let's talk about him for a minute before we introduce him. He writes a lot of books.
Incredible hair. He has incredible hair.
Does he really?
He does.
I don't know. I'm taken aback by his eyes more than anything. He has magnificent eyes. But seriously, he is the writer of Hulk, the Red Hulk book for Marvel. And he writes one of my favorite ongoing monthlies right now, and that's Thunderbolts. He is also he does a lot of creative work as well. He recently did Underground with Image and Mysterious the Infathomable for Wildstorm. And he's quite prolific, especially in the last year or so. He's just been doing a lot. He's basically the guy that put Agents of Atlas on the map for Marvel, and he's done quite a bit of everything. Heck, X-Men First Class was one of his first Marvel books, if you recall.
Yes.
Yeah.
Our mutual favorite webcomic right now, Bucko.
Yes, Bucko. He is the writer of that book. Of course, that's Jeff Parker we're talking about. We'll be talking to him in a couple of minutes. And we will, and we'll just kind of go over his career, talk about, his life before comics and what comics have done for his life in the last few years. I've always liked Jeff. He's really funny. He's really entertaining, and damn it, he's a great writer. He's one of my favorites month in and month out, and I've been looking forward to this talk for a while.
Yeah, definitely. He's one of those guys who's just been kind of plugging away behind the scenes, who a lot of people go, they just haven't heard the name, but he's doing really just fantastic work. A lot of people came to him because of X-Men First Class, but he's held those people in because the quality of his writing hasn't sunk. Like, there's really no ceiling for this guy, and all of his creator-owned stuff is really cool, so.
Yeah, what I love about him the most, of course, is his humor. His sense of humor is unlike anything else, He's very clever as well. There's a lot of things he does. He's really as far as his mainstream comic work goes. I mean, this guy he's really good with the continuity stuff. He's really good at coming up with his own concepts, and really the fact that he was able to dust off like characters like the Agents of Atlas characters and somehow made them his own. And
taking Ellis's Thunderbolts concept, spinning it a different way, throwing Luke Cage in there. I mean, come on.
Yeah, he's really good. With any kind of concept you throw at him, he just makes it his own. And that's one of the things I really love about his work. Hopefully, in the interview, you guys will get a glimpse at his creative process and get to see his point of view on the work that he puts out. So, enough of us here. We'll take you right to our chat with Jeff Parker. Enjoy. And we are back. And this time we are joined by the guy we were talking about earlier, Mr. Jeff Parker. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Hey, whoa. Hello. What were you saying about me?
Oh, we were talking about
how... You were talking about me?
We were talking about how pretty your eyes were.
I'm not cool with that. Okay.
Hey, you have very pretty eyes, and Adam thinks your hair is dreamy.
Oh, okay. Well, that's fine. It's kind of green.
So, welcome, Jeff. We're very pleased to have you on today. We've been fans of your work for some time, and we were always wondering, what were you up to before you put out your very first graphic novel, which is the Interman.
At the time, I was I was living in Los Angeles, and I was doing storyboard work. I had drawn comics quite a bit in the 90s, but it was always here and there and fill in, so it was impossible to find me or track me down. And then at some point in the late 90s, when the comics industry was so incredibly in the toilet, I realized that if I wanted to do anything, I needed to probably move out and just work in cartoons. And so I went to work for Sony for the Big Guy and Rusty the Boy robot cartoon that was on Fox Kids. And and I was storyboarding for that for a season. And then I started just picking up work doing live-action storyboards for, like, commercials and music videos and things like that. During that time, that's when I started realizing, like, oh, good, I can get back on the Interman, because now it's like I've got a little extra time in the week. I'm not busy all the time. And so I got back on that and gradually finally finished that book. And then after that, people started to trust me to write. And then they forgot I drew it all, so it's just never come up since.
Okay.
That's the way it goes.
Yeah. I was curious, though. You mentioned you were doing fill-ins back in the 90s. Were you working under a pseudonym or something like that, like Gabe Hardman did? Or
No, I wasn't like Gabe Hardman. Just always so embarrassed of myself that I'm calling myself by other names. It was a – no, I was a – let me think and try to remember some. A lot of, some DC stuff. You can always find my stuff if you find those Paradox Press's big book of things.
Okay.
I have one of those in most of those books. What I first regularly worked on was there used to be a comics company called Malibu, and I came in after Jeff Johnson and did a big run on the book called Solitaire. And after that, I worked on like a Justice League annual and a couple issues of Wonder Woman and stuff here and there. It was just, like I say, it was never anything where I was on something long enough that anybody would ever remember who I was. And since I probably drew different every time, you'd probably never remember anything I drew that way either, because I didn't have a very strong style.
Ah, that's very interesting. Now I'm going to want to seek out some of your old stuff, and I'm just going to bring them to you at a random con here.
That's what I love, because I like to be embarrassed with shitty old work. Nothing makes me happier.
I'm just kidding, Jeff.
Crap, here's something I drew when I was a kid. This is great.
Yeah, I was rather taken aback by that, because I my first memory of you and your stuff was always with Interman, and then
I'm fine with that. That's where I want it to start for everybody.
Okay.
You should always be working like 10 years, and then whatever you're doing be the first thing that everybody knows about. That's actually a perfect, I think, in any creative industry. So I'm totally cool with that being my showing up in everyone's radar.
That's when you actually broke in, and you forget about the fact that you worked for like major publishers even back in the day. But yeah,
they were putting out so much stuff. It's like, how would you even find it? You know, it's like everybody was putting out a zillion comics a month.
Yeah, so I guess you basically just did work for Malibu, DC, and maybe whatever else you probably can't remember at this point.
Yeah, a little odd. Okay. Odd work here and there.
So you completed the Interman, and what eventually got you back to doing work for the major publishers? Because after that, I think the next time I heard of you was when you started doing X-Men First Class.
Uh-huh.
And what got you what made you decide to pitch for Marvel, or were you approached with regards to that?
I was approached by Mark Fenice, who I'd done some work for before, and then he found a book I'd given him. I did a small press book. Now I'm trying to remember which book it actually came out in. It was Lone Star Press. Bill Williams, if you've seen him online, he got me to do a backup story. And I did this kind of tribute to Joe Kubert, the Tarzan and Sergeant Rock books together called Ape Company. And I had it on my website too for a long time. And so I just, this was just something with these apes in a combat unit in World War II that occurred to me one night. And I thought it was so funny. I got up and I roughed the entire thing out and then started working on it the next day. And it's perfect proof. And I think Mark found the book when he was moving to New York and working for Marvel, and going through all his books, and then read it again, and it kind of, even though of course it didn't look anything like a Marvel book or anything they were doing, it was just like the assignment he had just been given, which was he was supposed to head up the Marvel Adventures line and find people that could do just done-in-one issues and stuff that would work for people who had no familiarity with the characters or anything, you know, because it's supposed to be the go out and meet people in Target and Walmart who don't necessarily read any comics at all, you know. And since I had done this little 10-pager that you didn't need to know anything about before you started reading it, you know, that's when he called me up and asked me to pitch some ideas for a fill-in. And the first one I pitched, they had a fill-in on Spider-Man, the Marvel Adventures Spider-Man. And my pitch was Goom Got Game. It was if Goom came to Earth. And I don't know if you know the one I'm talking about, but he, like, Reed has been broadcasting. He was broadcasting PBS into the negative zone, hoping that somebody would, learn the language or connect to the broadcast and he could communicate with someone. And from then on Goom's planet, you know, Johnny came in and turned it to shows he wanted to watch. So it's all old YoMTV raps somehow, even though that had been off the air for a decade, and NFL football and stuff like that. And so Goom comes in talking all gangster and everything when they accidentally summon him to Earth, and him and Human Torch and Spider-Man have to deal with him. And from then on, they just trusted me. They handed me the keys to the kingdom. It's like, well, if you can give us hip-hop talking Kirby monsters, you know, you're in.
You really can't go wrong with Goom, though. He's one of the coolest looking monsters that they have.
Yeah,
and
he's got diapers on.
There's so much fun to be had with those characters. So I can, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing more of those guys. So with that in mind, like, you know, they have you doing X-Men First Class. And what was there a particular obviously you had to concentrate on the first five, and
it had to not interfere with any of the continuity. It was supposed to be in continuity, so I couldn't contradict anything they had done before, and that made it actually a really hard assignment. Everybody thinks because the stories are kind of simple and everything that I obviously had an easy time with it, and it's really the hardest thing I've done at Marvel was that series. Because of constantly trying to find ways for them to do things that didn't affect, decades of X continuity.
Wow.
You know, that was a pain. But I think it turned out really well, and had a great time working with Roger Cruz, and that's how I got Colleen Coover working into Marvel more and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I got to work with Nick Ergotta.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I really enjoyed that book. I thought I think you brought out some of the best work out of Roger Cruz. And at that time, Roger Cruz hadn't really done anything since, of course, since the mid to late 90s. You know, he disappeared for a bit, and then he came back, and he's doing that book. And
he was really into it. It was nice too, because I remember at one point they asked him. Someone else at Marvel asked him to do some other kind of high-profile thing, and now I can't remember what it was, but Roger turned them down because he liked working on the book with me. I was like, oh, that was nice. I tried to always, like, ask him what kind of stuff he wanted to draw and everything, and in one story I even set a scene in Brazil so he could draw all his friends in and all this stuff, and, you know, so even though we had quite a language barrier because I speak no Portuguese, you know, we got along really well, and I think we clicked pretty well on it.
Yeah, I can really tell he was really into it, and I think he was a good choice too. He's done you know, mainstream X-Men books. He did the Age of Apocalypse stuff and all that other all those books. But I think his work really shined here. I think his work is really good for his characters make really good. He does really good teenagers basically, and it worked out well.
Oh yeah, yeah. And, he does real young people that look like young people.
Yeah.
Which is apparently harder than it sounds.
Well, it really is, yeah. I mean, I've tried to draw young people. I'm not good at it. since that, though, I mean, I was kind of curious, did you have any kind of jumping ahead a bit here, but did you have any kind of input with the movie that's coming out now that's titled after your book?
Yeah, all they did was borrow the title of the book. That was about the entire influence of it.
Really?
Don't think I tried to get involved because I felt like they should have bought me a car or something. Even though Even though I didn't create the X-Men or really anything to do with the movie, I still feel like, shouldn't someone pay me off for just no reason at all? Just because I know that happens sometimes. But I'm hearing a lot of good buzz about it. It sounds like it's turning out really well from what early reports, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot of good. It debuted at 100% on Rotten Tomatoes like the other day.
Really? So
that's pretty fantastic.
It's weird. I keep getting people tweeting at me and writing to me saying, I'm so angry about this. They have completely stayed away from what you did in the book and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, look, why do you guys care? I don't care. Why do you care? So I just want to go see some mutants bouncing around doing cool stuff and lifting submarines out of the water. You know, I don't care if it's not in the order that it all happened or whatever. There's always a way to put that stuff back later if they want to. You know, I think people get too worked up about it. But
yeah,
I never care about continuity anyway. It's just not that important to me.
Well, you know, they care because they love you, Jeff.
No, they. I don't know. They just love the X-Men.
Well, that's also
or sort of. They have. It's weird. X fans. There's a weird contingent of X fans, as well. You probably know, and. It's strange. They don't even seem to like the rest of Marvel Comics. Like, they consider X-Men its own line, and it has nothing to do. And they don't like it when it has anything to do with the other Marvel characters. Yeah, it's just very strange to me. I never got it.
Yeah, they're missing out then.
Because I didn't come into it through the X-Men. I came into it through, you know, Spider-Man or the way you know, a lot of little kids would. Yeah, I like the Fantastic Four, blah, 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 and then find out about the X-Men later. And I think if you come in through the X-Men, you've got a different sort of experience. Vague theory. Sorry, Adam.
Oh, no worries. You were talking about continuity constraints, though. Is it something that you try to be observant of, even though it doesn't mean a lot to you? Because Pat and I, in the intro that we did, we were talking about how you pull in a lot of continuity stuff, you know, things that have been bygone, like for your books like Thunderbolts and, you know, Hulk and all that. Is it something that you try to be at least a little conscious of, or you try to at least use it as a way to enrich your stories?
Oh, yeah. Well, in stuff like Hulk and Thunderbolts, I have to pay attention to it. But at the same time, it's like I try to do a brief acknowledgement of, say, like if you see characters and they would have known each other, like Songbird, you know, would have known Mr. Hyde from time in the Masters of Evil, stuff like that. I can't stop the story and have them go, hey, Mr. Hyde, remember that time in the Masters of Evil? There you go, we're fighting Thor and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's just no. I guess someone cares about that, but, you know, I feel like, no, we're trying to tell an action story here, and we can't just keep plotting down and shoveling continuity on top of people. It's like we can make a brief reference to it, and then let's move on. So, yeah, I try to be knowledgeable about all of it. I've read a lot of it, so, you know, but at the same time, I treat it more like I always kind of go to the example of the Batman the Animated Series from the WB in the 90s, where, you know, they brought in a lot of the classic stories, but they weren't slavish to them, and you didn't really have to know anything about them. All you that really ever mattered was that the characters were consistent. You know, I think that's the main thing, that, you know, the characters need to act like you would think they would act, and you know, don't change the continuity wildly, like, you know, I don't know, Bruce Wayne came from Krypton or something, but, you know, don't, but, you know, also don't be a slave to it. It's just people get so wound up on it on message boards and everything. It's like, this is exactly the kind of thing that keeps the rest of the world out. I've had many of those books. I remember years ago when Nexus was coming out, and I didn't read it at first because I thought, well, looks like it's been going on a long time. I'll never be able to get into that. And then I finally read one that was a good entry point and went back and started reading it all. But, you know, I tried to keep things kind of cyclical so you're not lost when you come into a series. Hulk, I feel like I'm getting the best results with that. I feel like it's like you can read it with all the other stuff and understand what's happening, or you could come into it completely cold and you're still fine. And I wish I could pull that off all the time.
Mm-hmm. With you mentioned playing continuity, I thought you mentioned Hulk also. I thought you did a really good job picking up the pace on that book, because there were people, of course, were a little worried about how the book would do, since it started out with a guy like Jeff Loeb and Ed McGuinness working on it, and you and Gabe Hardman really picked up on that and followed through on some of the stuff we've established, in particular involving the Watcher. Because I never thought that the Watcher could be such a vindictive, petty jerk.
Well, you gotta keep reading though. There's more to it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, I do like the idea that he's just going to stand by and watch him go into black hole and go, I wish I could help you, but I'm the Watcher. And all I can do is watch you go into that black hole. The story I'm writing right now that I'm almost done with is the conclusion of that whole big year-long arc, mm-hmm. Where everything comes to a head. Omega-X finally makes it to Earth and starts wailing away on the Hulk. And Yurevo, the girl watcher, as I like to call her, shows up and gets back into the story again. I just hope that there can be more of a room for Yurevo, the girl watcher, somewhere in the Marvel Universe, because I really like this character. She's a younger, more teenage watcher. She's only like 20,000 years old.
Well, they have established for a long time that there are multiple Watchers. I'm pretty sure there's a place for her around the Marvel Universe.
Yeah. I think she ought to hang out as his assistant or something, though, so she can be around Earth, help him watch, or something. Yeah, because all the major civilizations have a Watcher assigned to them.
Of course. Again, kind of in the same subject that you were picking up on older continuity, Agents of Atlas.
Uh-huh.
I know there's always been some, there are a lot of people who liked those old, 50s Avengers, and I always wondered how you end up getting that particular project, because, I don't know if there have been a lot of active pitches for that book to come out.
But I don't think there were any. I really don't think anybody ever brought it up.
Yeah. Okay.
Except for that one bit where they appear in Kurt Busiek's
Avengers Forever. Yeah.
Avengers Forever story. Yeah.
Yeah, that was the last time anyone ever saw them. I was wondering, were you pitching for that, or was it something that was given to you by? I think it was it Mark Panichia who was editing.
Yeah, it's Panichia again, and he had just come across it, and he asked me to look at it, see if I might have any ideas about it. And I looked at it, and of course I was immediately like, man, this thing's great. There's a gorilla and a robot and a love goddess, and it's got everything. Of course, immediately I thought, 3D man is kind of hard to explain. He doesn't feel like a natural fit. But I kind of put it off to the side because I got a kind of idea how he would fit in, but not at once. And Jimmy Woo's cool and ought to be an active member instead of like the guy who just sends them out on missions. And of course, then reading the story again, they had Namora in it. And it's like, wow, if you put Namora in here, then you've really got something. And, in almost no time, I had to write that pitch over and over again. But I had the initial one to him really fast. I was completely into it. So I'm glad we got it through. It was hard to get anything through because all Marvel cared about that year was Civil War. That's what was going on.
Oh, yeah.
And, and that's why we came out, and almost no one knew what, realized we were even doing anything. It's me and Leonard Kirk over there working on this series that, wasn't Civil War. But yet we managed to get quite a few books out of it, and I feel like we did a lot of neat stories.
Yeah, I was glad that it kind of gained a following, and it kept going for a bit until the last series ended. It was kind of weird to see they're doing a Fear Itself tie-in that has the agents in it, and I saw that you weren't writing. I thought that was strange.
Yeah, it was. But I thought, well, it's like it's not mine. I don't own them or anything. Let somebody else write them and see how it works or whatever. I knew the basic things of what was going to happen in that, but I haven't I haven't read it since it's been finished, so I still need to read it.
Okay, well, like I said, it's just weird because, hey, the agents are back, and I saw who was writing. Like, oh, it's not Jeff. That doesn't feel right.
Yeah, well, that's probably, I could have actually have hurt the characters by putting my stamp on them so hard. But then it becomes hard to write them unless you happen to be me. And that's not some praise of myself. It's just like if I did it too personally, then it's kind of hard to translate them. But I think Gorilla Man's going to turn up in another book pretty soon, written by a writer I really like. So, we'll have to watch out for that.
Is that writer you?
Huh?
Is that writer you?
Oh, no. It's, okay. No, it's someone else. It's someone else.
Okay.
But I think it'll be a neat place for him to appear.
Cool.
Gorilla Man really ought to be able to just go around and bounce it in anybody's book at Marvel, though. He's a perfect character to just drop in wherever.
Yeah, he's a great, he really is a lot of fun, and I think he really can fit in anywhere, and you can't really go wrong with a gorilla, seriously.
Yeah. I think a lot of people got confused because it looked like, it's like, what is this, a DC comic or something? It's like they're gorilla. And it was kind of intentionally sort of DC feeling. It's like it's from the 50s when Marvel and DC weren't really that different,
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of transitional time before all the superheroes came back.
He really was a product of his time, but I think you did a pretty good job bringing him into the present day. I really liked all those Atlas characters, though, and I'm glad that they're here and they have some kind of presence these days. But I still miss your book because you and Gabe really did you left a mark on those characters, and it's really hard to kind of disassociate them from you and vice versa.
Oh, thank you. And I miss writing Jimmy Woo. It's like I liked having this idealistic guy, mm-hmm. who really had been a kind of probably burnout, cynical guy at the end of his career, but then he gets a second chance and everything. So he was kind of fun. Hopefully I'll try to get them in. I'm not going to try to shoehorn them in anywhere they don't fit. But, we'll see if they can turn up some more.
Are the agents just a way to feed your obsession with gorillas? Like, is that really just as far as it goes?
Not really, because I could just have Red Ghost turn up all day long and or whatever. That's the weird thing. I really don't care about these gorillas as much as everybody assumes. I just like that gorilla. It's like I felt like I got his voice just right, and it's like, if they had if they ever did a TV show or a movie, they could get Patrick Warburton to do the voice for him. It would be perfect.
Now, nobody that's listening to this is going to be able to unhear that.
Exactly. They shouldn't.
You just had.
Yeah, just imagine him doing the voice for him and CGI or a really well-made suit or something for that.
Pixar, man.
But, Gabe Hardman really showed off on his run on it. I mean, because we did every kind of – in that short time we had, we did every kind of story, and he had everything in the world to draw, and he killed it all of it, the mythology stuff, the kind of conspiracy thing once 3D Man comes into it. It's just gorgeous to look at.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that just kind of came out of nowhere and was doing really cool work. I mean, I don't really think there's a lot like his art out there. It's, you guys make a good team, Do you work pretty closely with him, or do you have the opportunity to?
I often bug him about what he would like to draw, and he tries not to answer, and then he'll eventually answer me. And then, we go back and forth a lot with the layouts and stuff. I mean, usually he's always just nailing it, and my back and forth is just saying, that looks awesome. But, we'll talk about what things are supposed to play like or what it seems. But, like, Gabe is he's a pretty popular storyboard artist for film. And, Christopher Nolan and Sam Raimi and all these guys always come to him to do work on their movies. So it's like his big imagination, he's used to drawing everything in the world and making it look expensive. it's a very easy transition for him to do comics. And that's why it just feels like it has such a big scope once he comes into it. you know, it's been interesting watching him get into Red Hulk because his thing wasn't really big muscular characters, but again, because he's Gabe Hardman, he can do it. He just comes in and kind of owns that too.
Yeah, I actually talked to Gabe about a couple months ago on the show, and he did talk about how you guys are, you know, work pretty closely together and how you guys have a real good process going as far as putting the book together. Do you have Gabe's one thing, but with your other artists, like you mentioned Roger Cruiser earlier, you have the language barrier thing. Are there any other out of all the people you've worked with, though, aside from Gabe, who else have you gotten really close with as far as like your rapport or communication goes, or do a lot of your collaborators go for your editor instead?
There's a lot of collaboration with Kev Walker on Thunderbolts.
Oh yeah,
like Kev comes back. Kev's a good writer too, so he'll come back a lot of times after I've written a scene, especially if it's a just pure action fight scene. And he'll come back and, you know, he's just makes suggestions. He's like, I think I could pull it off better if we did this. And he'll give me all these notes and show me how it could break down instead. So I save all that stuff. And then when it comes for a final lettering pass, I'll change it closer to whatever Kev was going for. And I think that's why the book reads the way it does. It's, you know, if you read something where someone handed off an inventory story, you know, like a year before, and then some artist finally got assigned to it and drew it, it always has a kind of stilted reading to it. If you don't go back and forth between the creators, you know, I just don't think it works that well most of the time. Some artists can compensate, but I think most of the time you need both of them bending to each other, and then a final pass at the dialogue to make sure it really feels like that's what's being said everywhere. You know, I've been working with Declan Shalvey on some of the Thunderbolt stuff too, and you know, and he and I go back and forth. He'll email me all day long asking questions, and I encourage it. It's like, you know, I don't want anybody to be in a mystery about what I was going for. So, and at first, it's always hard when people start working together. You know, you don't know each other that well, and you haven't worked together. Like Gabe and I have now worked together so much, I can describe things in the vaguest of terms, and he knows what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And I have to watch it when I'm working with other people to not write the script the same way I would write it for Gabe, you know. And he gets that. It, you know, he would explain how he gets that from like Sam Raimi, and Sam Raimi will tell him things like, "Give me a Captain Kirk here," and what he's talking about is a particular type of close-up shot that he wants, and it's just this weird language that only Sam Raimi speaks that Gabe had to figure out. You know, and it's like, so we kind of do like that. We go do shorthand, and often we're referring to movies or Twilight Zone episodes or something. It's like, make this like To Serve Man or blah, blah, blah or something, you know. So we both know what we're riffing on at the time. It makes it more fun anyway.
Well, yeah, it's always good if you like I said, if you've developed a rapport or a really close tie with the person you're working with.
You just got to give the artist room. You can't say no. I have this in my head, and hold on to it unless it's a very particular story point that you've really got to get across, mm-hmm. or the whole thing doesn't work. Most of the time, when the artists are coming back with different suggestions, it's just something they've got that would flush it out even more. And usually it would behoove you to go ahead and go with that idea. And I'm usually fine with that. Unless my super brilliant idea is just going to be compromised.
And you mentioned working with artists again. And, you yourself are an artist at one point. You were an artist at one mm-hmm. point, or you probably still are, because you still draw really cool sketches in people's books.
Yeah, I still secretly draw when no one's looking.
When does that affect the way you write scripts for everyone else? Like, do you get them really detailed as far as like, you know, the panel descriptions? Or, and you did mention that you do try to let the artists go and do their own thing with the scripts. But I was wondering how much influence do you throw in there?
And I try to give
them allowance to do what they need to do.
Yeah, I try to not call shots too much. I'm still kind of bad about it because I feel like I, it's like I'm just trying to save them a little time in visualizing. Mm-hmm. But I never asked for something that I couldn't draw myself. And I always try to think in terms of what would be fun to draw, you know, that, which is why you tend to not get a whole bunch of talky scenes from me. You get it once in a while, and then, you know, and then you can tell that I clearly felt awkward doing it, and they immediately start shooting things, and things start blowing up all over the place because I just don't. I have no attention span, and I assume my readers are the same way I am. And also, just who gets into comics art to just draw a conversation? You know, you got into it, I assume, because you wanted to draw monsters and cool hidden cities and spaceships and all this stuff, and that's what I tend to go for. I don't think a whole lot different than I did when I was 10, mm-hmm. except that I've read more since then and seen a lot of movies that yeah, I really try to make it visual, and it's like that Newsarama interview, the workshop I did the other day.
That was great, by the way.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. And I was the one of the points I was trying to get out, and then it turned into a little minor discussion on Twitter. It was about the things, or so, a lot of people say, "I like dialogue first," and I feel like you should just write whatever's coming to you first, and maybe you can't help but think of the dialogue that people are saying. But I feel like that means you think that story is only advanced by what is said. And I don't think it should be that way. I feel like you should maybe see a scene unfold or maybe hear the dialogue and just go with whatever's coming to you. But, you know, just don't think of it in terms of what people are saying, because it's about what they're doing. And you should be able to write the whole thing with no dialogue and have it sort of make sense, you know, and try to let that dialogue, like, take you even further. But, you know, of course, I'm getting into thing how people's heads work, and that's probably not fair for me to talk, because surely no one's heads all work the same, I don't think. I don't know. What do you do when you do it?
you're asking me as a guy that makes comics? Or
Yes, because you do. I've seen you doing it before.
Well, I guess I kind of do it the same way you do. You know, I try to make it as easier for the person I'm collaborating with, but I'm writing anyway, and when I draw, you know, I basically just do what I'm told.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, I mean, as far as drawing goes, I mean, in my mind, you know, the more descriptive it is, the easier it is for me to convey what the writer's idea is. Of course, I try to have dialogue as well with whoever I work with whenever I'm drawing for someone. And when, as far as me writing, usually, again, I only work with certain people. And I know I could talk to them. I could trust them to do things. So I write based on whatever skills the person I'm working with has. So I try to tailor everything, because everything we've done is, you know, little short stories and you know, all create our own stuff. So. I haven't really had the type of challenge that you would probably have with as far as characters go, because these are all our own characters, basically.
Yeah, I guess sometimes it helps to write a script and put a ton of detail in there, but make it clear to the artist, I don't mean that you have to draw all this.
Well, yeah.
I'm just trying to flesh it out so it's built in your head. I feel like that's what happens with Alan Moore scripts. You know, he writes these famously long scripts. And, like, back in the – I remember, like, in the late 80s or 90s or whatever, when they started reprinting parts of his scripts and people saw how he wrote, you know, then a lot of writers kind of glommed on to, well, I'm going to write like Alan Moore. And it's like, no, you don't need to write a page per panel description or everything. It's just the way Alan Moore, thinks. He would kind of get himself in the mood or whatever and talk all this stuff. And it kind of helped build the thing for him. It didn't mean every single detail had to be in there, even though, you know, if you were Dave Gibbons, he would just go ahead and draw every detail mm-hmm. in there. But I think one thing it does do is what artists tend to appreciate is they want to know that you've really given the thing thought and that you've made a real skeleton that matters, you know, that they're about to add to. And when you do fill in stuff to that degree and show that you've really spent a lot of time thinking about it, then they also step up. They tend to think, well, I better put a lot of time thinking into this too. And you can tell a script where someone hasn't done that, and it's like, wait a second, this thing doesn't even work. I could sneeze, and the script's going to blow apart. It's just there's nothing holding it together. And that kind of thing's really discouraging for an artist, as I can tell you from getting them when I was drawing other people's scripts. It's like, oh, I've got to make this work, but I don't believe in it. And then suddenly it's really hard.
Yeah.
And you really value just a very solid, constructed script.
Yeah. And that's kind of back to what I was saying about my own work style. I mean, when I depending on the people I work with, I'm usually very picky. And I only work with people I've known for quite a while now. Like, for example, Adam here, I've drawn scripts that he had written when we did our own graphic novel about a year ago. And I had fun with the script because he knows what I'm into. I know what he's into. And we did a lot of talking as to how the story goes. And every now and then we would make changes. And as far as me writing, I'm always open to whoever is drawing my script, I want to service the story in the best possible way. And if the artist has a better idea, we just go with that. My own scripting, is pretty sparse. It's just dialogue and basic description, and I just let them go wild with it. But I'm very picky with who I work with, though. So I wouldn't draw an Alan Moore type script if I was given one. That much I can tell you.
Would you be running through like Gibbons with the highlighter?
Yeah, I would highlight all of that, or just cross everything out completely, leave the one important sentence in there, and that's it.
Well, I've seen scripts from writers who. Yeah, they have no visual sense, and they keep calling for shots because I think they feel like I'm supposed to call for shots. and it's like, no, this won't look like anything when you draw it out. And a lot of artists I know, they'll just cross out those descriptions so they don't have to think about it. And that's fine. I try to limit it to, I usually will say, this can be small, or this should be a big moment. So people don't waste time drawing something that's not really that important. Like, no, you can just get away with a tiny little inset panel. All we need is a quick reaction shot from this character. It doesn't need to be a big moment. It'll feel wrong if it's a big moment. And by the way, this here should feel like a big splash, so this is the big moment. And usually everybody appreciates that. They mainly want to know what kind of emotion or feeling you're trying to convey with it. And I think that's probably more helpful to talk about it in those terms.
And riffing off of that, you've done a lot of creator-owned work also, aside from all the Marvel stuff. Mm-hmm. And I want to kind of touch upon Mysterious the Unfathomable for a little bit.
Good.
It has become quite a bit of a cult hit, I think, I'd like to say, because there's a lot of people have discovered it lately thanks to podcasts and just good buzz all over the internet. I was always curious as to how you guys decided to come up with the concept and how you and Tom Fowler hooked up to do the book.
I kind of salvaged it from a proposal I had written. I was invited to write something for Bob Schreck when he was at Vertigo. Said, "Hey, do you have any ideas with any of our characters you can write?" And I thought about it for a while and stared at things. And I said, well, what about this? And whenever they send those things out, it's always like it's very well crafted. So it looks like it's written just to you, but it's really a mass emailing. It goes out to a few writers at a time. And then when someone just comes back to them with whatever's closer to the kind of thing they were hoping to get, then you get something that's much more noticeable as a form letter saying, go away, boy, you bother me, or something. And it's just, well, thanks for your submissions, but it doesn't fit our criteria, blah, blah, blah. It's like, oh, you could have crafted that letter as well as you crafted the first one. But anyway, I had this half-proposal thing I'd written for another book. And then Ben Abernathy from Wildstorm had been writing me and was saying, hey, do you have any ideas so we could do something for Wildstorm? And I went back and looked at that, and I went, there was some good stuff in here. So I just pulled it out, because I wanted to do something supernatural. And that's when I started working at Mysteriously Unfathomable and went back to Ben with that, and they liked it. And at the time, I thought Tom was actually going to end up drawing the Spider-Man 1602 miniseries that I was starting to write. And I wasn't saying, let's go to Tom, even though I wanted to work with him, obviously. But then Marvel came back and said, no, we're going to go with somebody else. And that's when I said, hey, Tom's available. Let's ask him. And then Ben called or emailed Tom. So to Tom, in Tom's world, it was like he got this rejection. And then not a whole minute later, in came the other thing for another thing with me. It's like, what about this idea? And it must have just been a really strange few minutes for him. He barely gotten to go into mourning about the one series before another one presented itself, which is even better for him because this was also kind of like he and I ended up sort of making it a Douglas Adams tribute because it's very much like a supernatural Doctor Who. If Doctor Who were just a horrible person and the companion were, you know, functioning as his conscience, and then once Tom came in, then we started shaping it more together. And going back and forth, and he's doing the designs. And then Tom's one who's also a writer, so he'll just start throwing out neat ideas and fleshing out scenes that I wasn't even going to really go that far into the background. I was really proud of that. And I think that's why people kind of really, when they do find out about the book and get it, they really get into it. And I just hope we can do more because I've got more stories, and he and I keep coming up with stuff, and now we've just got this backlog of things we would like to do with Mysterious.
And the character is still, of course, your property, right? Or is it something that DC has ownership of as well?
Yeah, it's kind of half and half. It's like, yeah, we own it, but DC has all the rights to do anything with it in other media. So to get it completely back, we'd have to go pay them for all the money they spent on that miniseries. And so I'm hoping something will happen where I get a chunk of money and I can go do that because I really would like it back if they're not going to do anything.
I would love to see sequels for this thing because this is a lot of fun.
I know.
Yeah.
Our next one, we wanted to send him in Delphi to Ireland. I would love to get going on that. I made a ton of notes for that story.
Adam, you had a question with regards to series.
Yeah, I was really interested in where the kernel for Underground came from because I would also say that Mysterious comes from an area where it's like we haven't seen a lot of comics like that, but Underground is really like, I mean, it's a simple thing, but I've never seen a story like that. Like, where did it come from? What made you want to do a story like that?
Well, that was all Lieber tricking me into doing the story, really. He wanted to, after he did Whiteout, he wanted to do something. One, he wanted to do something where he had some shadows and could use ink because he had been, you know, spending hundreds of pages coming up with ways to depict snow. He had started reading and watching videos about caving because he was just kind of curious about doing a cave adventure. And he did a little short story initially, with the character, with Wesley. And I was kind of egging him on, like, yeah, go ahead and write, because I know Lieber can write, even though he won't ever show off and do it. And he just kind of kept telling me all the stuff he was researching at the time until I finally knew about him, as much of it as he did. And then he sort of, like, kind of suckered me into working. And the next thing I know, I'm just suddenly writing the book, and like I'm not really sure at what point that happened, but I kind of went back to I started thinking, well, you know, we could do it against the backdrop of this kind of poor town, and how the idea of a show cave popping up would affect all of them, and we just wanted to do a lot of things that we can't normally do in a DC Marvel comic, like have a lead character who's not some supreme ass kicker. You know, Wesley would be completely useless in a fight. She's a little tiny woman, but she's excellent at getting through caves and knows all about them. it's all about her knowledge making a difference, and you know, and her maybe boyfriend Seth, who's along for the ride, is he's your conventional lead in a book, but he kind of doesn't get a chance to do that till the very end, because all he can do is kind of follow her and listen and learn. So that when you get to the point where he finally gets to punch somebody, it's like this enormous relief for him. You know, he gets to slam some guy in the head. Finally, something I can do. But it was really cool, and we learned all these facts along the way, like the thing about exploding bat poo and stuff like that. Everything in there is possible.
What made you decide to set it in Kentucky? Was that just a convenient thing, or are you from there originally? Or
I'm from North Carolina. Isn't too far away. But what I was thinking of was to make the connection to Mammoth Cave, which is in Kentucky. And, it seemed like a likely place for another cave system like that. And because there certainly are caves around there people just don't even know about, probably. And and then obviously the people in the town who are wanting to get this turned into a show cave, you know, they would be thinking in terms of Mammoth, like, okay, if we can make this that kind of attraction, you know, this town can start making money again and put people back to work. And we wanted to make it not a, we didn't want to make it, it's like, the environment is the right thing and this is the wrong thing, or vice versa. You know, we wanted to make it a complex issue as the backdrop of it. It's like you kind of empathize with Wesley and you see what she's saying. She doesn't want to despoil nature. At the same time, these people really could use jobs. And, you know, it's like neither of them are bad. Neither side is bad. You know, I feel like that gets, especially in terms of comic books, because we're so used to dealing with good and evil all the time, that we oversimplify situations in real life that way, too. And I felt like, you know, we could show that it's like, oh, no, there's a lot of gray area in all this stuff. And,
is that duality something you like to play up in your stories? Because, I mean, like you said, comics do end up getting a little black and white, or at least one-sided on certain issues. So is that something that you try to always give kind of a prismic quality to? Or?
Yeah, and I feel like even in something like Thunderbolts, we get to do it a lot, you know. It's like where you get to show the other side of the coin. It's like, well, you know, everybody didn't grow up in a great situation where everybody didn't have an Uncle Ben to inspire them. Some people are just around horrible people all their lives, and if they get superpowers, they're probably not going to do the right thing with it, you know. But then you kind of, if I can still make you relate to them, then I feel I pulled it off, you know, even though it's like, wow, I'm not a world conqueror at all, but I'm kind of going along with MODOK on this one.
I think you did a pretty good job with Thunderbolts, still, with all the characters, making them relatable, except for maybe for Crossbones. But then again, you can't really relate to Crossbones. That guy's just bad.
Then I started to feel a little worried when people did relate to him. I was like, hey, you're forgetting how bad he is.
Yeah, or maybe readers just as bad as he is.
Well, that's the fun thing too, to kind of jerk the rug out from under people. You know, start making them root for somebody and then have them do something really horrible so they just don't know how to feel. I love tricking people like that.
And touch upon one other thing, another one of your own creation. So we'll talk about Bucko for a little bit, your webcomic with Eric Mohn. It's basically a webcomic. Yeah, it's free to everybody at buckocomic.com, everybody.
There will be a link in the show notes.
Yes, there will be a link. Well, see, Adam's really good at this now. Okay.
Oh, thank you.
But basically, I want to say we love the webcomic. It's so much fun. One of the things I've been curious about is how did you and Eric Mohn decide to, you know, put this together? I think you guys are studio mates, right, at Periscope?
It is, but it was mainly because she was talking in some interview somewhere about she had just been reading Mysterious, and she was really getting into it, and she said, I'd like to work with my studio mate, Jeff Barger. But she wasn't saying it to me. She was just saying it, but like any egomaniac, I have the Google alert set up to find any reference to me anywhere on the Internet. And I was like, oh, what's this Rarick is talking about me? And then I went up to her afterwards and went, you want to work with me on something? And then we kind of would start babbling a little back and forth just until we started putting something together. And, you know, I just kind of asked her, you know, what does she want to work with? And she wanted to work with something with 20-somethings as a cast. And then I just started kind of doing this sort of meta exercise where I kept building it around, you know, our life here in Portland. So everything kind of becomes, like, everybody in the book rides bikes because, you know, we ride bikes or whatever. And then I started to, even though Erica was adamant about, I want to get away from autobio for a while, I just made it bio because I kind of kept couching details about her life into the story. And it makes a lot of fun for me. And she hasn't really objected to it yet, so I'm just going to keep doing that. Anyway, and I feel like it's kind of an exercise in doing something different than the way I do other books. So hopefully you get a little unpredictability to the story. And you feel like, well, this isn't something I've read every day, which is what I'm hoping for. But yet you still feel obliged to keep checking in twice a week and going along with it.
You mentioned you were kind of going by a lot of things that go on in Portland. I was are the characters based off of people you know or based off of yourselves even?
Oh, yeah. There's plenty of us in it. There's plenty of just people that we know around town, even though we disguise them and try to hide it from whoever the actual people are. You know, it's like I said, it's a very meta sort of strip. And little developments that will happen will just end up into the thing. Like the other day, Erica just complaining because she had a huge zit on her back. And I immediately got that into the script. I went, well, no, wait, I can use that. That's perfect for this part of the party. And, so I feel like that way it's kind of inviting life to write the story for me. So, yeah, I generally know where it's going, but also it could completely surprise me as well.
Have you had any weird Grant Morrison things springing into life coming out of that? Like, have you run into any giant squids lately as Erica?
Well, No way to say that. It seems like there is an answer to that, and it's not occurring to me at the moment. No, it's kind of weird. Like, I mean, I know it's like a kind of given to just say, "I'll set a story in the Midwest and have a tornado, and it'll probably happen." But it was weird to have Red Hulk fight a tornado, you know, a few weeks ago, right when just then suddenly it timed out, where just most incredible formation of tornadoes coming down the middle of the country.
Oh, wow.
In forever, it suddenly happened. And that's where I like to feel like, hey, we're the only people dealing with the real situations here. Red Hulk. And the same thing can happen in Bucko. He said, but since we write it the other way, because she is always, she and I both like octopuses for some reason. So octopi just keep turning up in the thing. I did a series that no one read called Walk-In for Virgin Comics a few years ago. And one of the main things in it, there's characters who are going around and they have octopi on their backs. And it's, the animals are connected to them and they're connecting them so that their brains can kind of see through another dimension. It makes sense when you read it. Eric had read that one too. He's like, ooh, octopus. You know, she went right for it. And she always puts octopuses into all of her artwork everywhere. So it was kind of natural that it would turn up in there. But, I had a real answer. It seemed like there was an octopus thing the other day, and now I can't remember what it was. And I'm going to call you back. Oh, put this into the podcast, because it just suddenly struck me. Something about octopi. There was a cool scene though. I loved that little scene of her fantasy after the zit pops, and then she's just like flying naked through the fantasy land, and then landing on a flying one. And the description I said, it's like a Miyazaki film. She just suddenly is feeling completely free, flying on top of this airborne octopus, and she nailed it. I mean, it was really a beautiful scene.
Yeah, you talk about giving artists fun stuff to draw, and I think Bucko is just like, you know, you've got such a talented artist there, and it's such a showcase of, you know, just really cool things done by really cool artists. And you guys are, it's a wonderful webcomic. Like, it's something that I really look for. You know, both of us, Pat and I, always, you know, when we're just talking on Skype, we always talk about Bucko and what's going on.
Oh,
in
good.
It, so.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we actually talked it up a bit in our episode last week as well. You know, we were talking about how more people should be checking it out. Yeah, we love it. It's so much fun.
I can't really tell. Sometimes I think, is anybody even reading it? And I can't tell because we keep comments turned off. And that was because when Erica was doing Dar, you know, just too many people writing in the comments suddenly felt really involved in her life. And that kind of happens a lot with online comics, you know. And we really didn't want that to happen this time, so we just kind of kept it off. And the only way you can ever tell us anything is to just tweet at us, which is fine by me. But, you know, it does kind of limit that sort of back and forth you might have. But then again, those things, they'll absorb your life, and you'll take them too personally. And then if someone comes in and says something mean, it ruins your day. So it's just not worth it.
Yeah, and we already know how bad things can be when it comes to, you know, when it comes to comic-related websites, how bad comments are. So
yeah.
You're better off that way, at least.
Exactly.
You know, for example, it's upsetting to me when I read a news story in Newsarama, and then I accidentally scroll further down, like, oh no, I didn't need to read that.
You know, why did I do it? Why did I look at the comments?
Exactly.
They haven't had comments in a while, have they?
What's that?
I don't think Newsarama's had comments for a while, have they? Or
didn't I haven't.
They still got the forums.
I think they still do. Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
I think it links directly to the forums now. Like, there's a talk about this at our forum. You know, link at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it can get even crazier than that. You know, Fraction got death threats for the back matter in Casanova and things like that. It's just, you know, people. Yeah, it's like you said, people just get way too involved in it and think that they're a part of people's lives, and it's yeah.
What about the back matter in Casanova or get him a death threat?
He talked about his and Kelly Sue's miscarriage, I believe. And somebody sent him a message, like an email, something about, you know, we don't want to hear about hipsters' miscarriages. And it's like, really? Is somebody going to go in that direction about it? You know, it was a really heartfelt thing where he was, you know, just kind of like.
Yeah, I remember writing that, but I didn't know that people were writing in horrible shit.
That's why he went away from the, you know, he didn't want to do the confessional back matter anymore, but that was like what put the nail in the coffin with it when he did the Marvel reprints. He just didn't want to have that sort of ridiculous, borderline insane backlash to something that he said, because, you know, when you're creating something, you're in a unique position where you can't really swing back, you know.
Right.
We spoke with him about this when we did podcasts with him, and it's just, you know, it's a difficult situation when you're just trying to create something that's very personal to you, and you're going to eventually do something that's going to offend someone, so.
Oh, well, pretty much every time out, and, but yeah, I guess that's the way to, it's hard to ever talk about any of that sort of stuff, because, yeah, then, again, like we're saying, people suddenly feel this connection that really they shouldn't be feeling. You know, they should only feel a connection through the art. And I think it's probably better to just back off and let the story speak for itself. Because,
exactly.
Yeah, you have no idea the weird ways people are going to react. Sometimes it's good, you know, but again, just one of those would be enough to put me off of it forever. I was just like, oh, okay, if someone's going to lose their mind over something I said, that it's like, I don't even know how they could get upset about that.
Yeah. And, Adam, did you have anything else to add?
Just kind of an exit question since we're hitting our time limit here. I love the NPR pop-ups in Underground, and I was curious, what's your favorite NPR show, man?
Car Talk. I still love Car Talk after a bit. I mean, I listen to all of it. I listen to, you know, Morning Edition and Weekend, All Things Considered, and all that sort of stuff. And on Sunday mornings, I'm always in that to make sure I'm in front when the Puzzle Master Will Shorts comes on from the New York Crossword and does his little puzzle thing. I'm always shushing everybody. Like, no, be quiet. I'm trying to listen to a stupid puzzle and trying to solve it because I just love puzzles. It's similar. Car Talk has the puzzler on it, you know, so I like solving that. And I just like, you know, that Tom and Ray Maliazzi are funny, and Scott Simon and all those people. I won't listen to Prairie Home Companion anymore. I've had enough of this show. It makes me feel old and tired of these same Minnesota jokes all the time.
and the same voices.
See, I never pegged you as a car talker.
I love Minnesota and I love people there.
I never really pegged you as a car talk guy, Jeff.
Really?
I don't know. It just never felt that way, just based off of your work. And then, I can kind of see that.
Haven't you noticed how I include a car for almost every character? everybody gets even Hulk has a car. Everyone gets a car. Man-Thing's the car in Thunderbolt.
Man-Thing is a car, yeah.
He is the car.
Yeah.
But I've focused on, even when I was doing Marvel Adventures Fantastic Four, there was a whole issue called Doom, Where's My Car, where Johnny ends up with Dr. Doom's old car and hot rods it and everything. And it was kind of a takeoff of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, too. So I got a zillion jokes, little double meanings going at once. And that's the weird thing. And since I work with Mark Fenicia so much, he's also a fairly big car nut, and he and I will always bore the rest of the team by trying to figure out what kind of car would this character be driving. Like, we went back and forth for a whole day just trying to figure out what the 3D man would be driving when you first see him in that Atlas story. And I ultimately went with a Maserati because their symbol, the little trident, is a three. In fact, that's a little detail, by the way, I don't think anyone noticed out of that storyline. Everywhere you see the 3D man, things are happening in threes around him, like he affects the universe. And it's a little detail that I came up with and Gabe put in everywhere he could, and no one picks up on it. And sometimes I feel like, though, people pick up on something even when they don't. Like, they realize something's going on, even if we're not calling a whole lot of attention to it. I just have to hope they do. But, yes, we always figure it out. At one point, we were trying to get a Doctor Strange series going, being like the 27th people in a row trying to get a Doctor Strange series going. And Sean Murphy, who ended up doing Joe the Barbarian, was initially going to be the artist.
Oh, wow. That was amazing.
Yeah, and Panicia had talked to him. And Panicia, of course, wanted him to have a car. And Sean went straight for a really cool choice. It was this, 65 Lincoln Continental with suicide doors. And it's like, you know what?
Yes.
That is a sweet pimping vehicle. That is exactly what I would expect Doctor Strange to ride around in if he was going to be driving around the country.
With his cloak on.
Yeah, with his coat and everything. It looked pretty sweet. And I was just going to put the little, his famous window as the little badge on the back of the car, so you would see that.
And he'll have the eye of Agamotto as a hood on him or something.
Yeah, and it would just be on the dash or something.
Oh, man, that would have been awesome. I would have been down with it.
It's because I was so ingrained as a kid in Batman. It's like everybody has a mobile. it's just like any character. Spider-Man had a spider buggy. Spidey-Man. That's what I like. saying it like I did when I was three. But it's like you had a spider buggy.
Man.
Even Superman had this little car he flew around in.
Yeah, I think every time a character is about to have a movie, they all of a sudden they have cars. I mean, I saw a toy.
Magically,
Iron Man toy,
they get cars.
That comes with a car. Like, Iron Man needs a car for what, really? He suits a car.
Yeah, he gets a car just so he has something to base his suit colors on.
All right, Jeff. Well, we've reached that point. Again, thank you for coming on the show. Was there anything that you wanted to plug before we sign off here?
Oh, nothing I can announce yet. So, yes, just please get Hulk and Thunderbolts because I feel like we're doing great stuff in them. And
I believe that. And, I agree.
Yeah, and then go watch Bucko in the in-between times because it costs you absolutely nothing.
Exactly. And, of course, you have all of your work that you can purchase through shops like Amazon or Discount Comic Book Service or on CheapGraphicNovels.com.
And, why, yes, you're right. Yes. You can do that.
You can purchase Mysterious, the Infallible, and Underground there, both at really discounted prices, so it doesn't hurt to try. And, of course, Jeff, you're on Twitter also, right? Twitter.com/Jeff Parker?
Yes, it's just Jeff Parker. So, yes, come follow me and ask me stupid questions and get my incredibly stupid answers back at you.
You could ask Jeff about how you know what type of ribs the Hulk likes to eat, the Red Hulk.
Yeah, we can talk about the Hulk sitting in truck eating ribs. Today we were having a big debate about how to justify eating Chick-fil-A's new banana pudding milkshake.
Man, Jeff has a very entertaining Twitter feed, so I highly recommend following him. And of course, Adam is on Twitter also at Adam Witt. And of course, you can find me at the usual spots, patloika.com or twitter.com/patloika, or the blog for this show at comicbooknoise.com/loikamania. Again, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us in the show. I really appreciate it.
And yeah, thanks, guys.
No problem, man. We love your work, and you know we wouldn't go through all this if we didn't. Actually, no. That makes it sound like this is a bad thing. No, we love your work, and we're very happy that we got you on today.
Yeah, Adam, are you going to go to the Heroes Con next week?
Oh, I wish. I wish. Are you going to be out there as well, or?
Yep, I'll be there. What about Baltimore?
I'm going to try to get up to Baltimore. I'd love to get up to Baltimore. I've seen you at a couple of shows.
Yeah, that's not too far for you.
Yeah, if I get to any of them, I'll definitely stop by your table. You did a sketch for my girlfriend one year of an orca whale, just because she's got a theme sketchbook for that. She loves your work. She found your work as a result of that. She wanted me to thank you. So
that's funny. I remember that because I don't get orca requests every day.
that is her thing. Yeah, at the same con you had me by Mysterious, and she stole the issues from me before I could even read them and fell in love with the book. I passed her around, and she really loves your stuff and wanted me to say hello.
Well, marry her. I don't mean to pressure you or anything, but
I will take it under advice.
Man, I just totally got you in trouble. I'm very sorry.
Yeah, this is all public.
Okay.
All right, everyone. We will see you all next week. And until then, take it easy. Some